Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
It's wonderful to see all of you here, and also welcome to our audience online. It's great to have so many people here with us this evening. So welcome to LSE for How Stories Can Transcend Borders and Boxes of Identity. Today's event is the keynote lecture for the Atlantic Fellows for Social and Economic Equity, AFSE, fellowship program based at the LSE. AFSE is aiming to build a catalytic, values-led global community of people who are committed to using collective leadership to work towards social and economic justice for all. My name is Armine Ishkanyan, and I'm the Executive Director of the Atlantic Fellows for Social and Economic Equity Program and a professor in the Department of Social Policy at LSE. I'm incredibly pleased to be here to welcome our keynote speaker, Elif Shafak. Welcome back to LSE. I know you've been here before. And our discussant, Lily Jamaluddin, to both our online audience and everyone joining us in person. Elif Shafak is an award-winning British-Turkish novelist, storyteller, and an advocate for women's rights, LGBTQ plus rights, and freedom of expression. She has published 21 books, 13 of which are novels, and her books have been translated to 58 languages. Elif holds a PhD in political science and has taught at various universities in Turkey, the US, and the UK. Elif is also a fellow and president of the Royal Society of Literature and a public humanities fellow at the School of Advanced Studies, SAS, at the University of London. She has been chosen among BBC's 100 most inspiring and influential women and is the recipient of the Haldor Laxness International Literature Prize for her contribution to the renewal of the art of storytelling. Thank you. I'm also very pleased to welcome Lily Jamaluddin, a writer, campaigner, and an Atlantic Fellow for Social and Economic Equity. Lily currently works as campaigns manager for Small Acts, a London-based campaigning organization. As a writer, Lily is passionate about the potential of creative writing as a tool for social change. She won the Mercedes-Benz Creative Excellence Award in 2017 for her short play, Our Compliance, in the Short Plus Suite Malaysia Theatre Festival, and was featured as an emerging writer in the 2018 Georgetown Literary Festival. Welcome back to LSE, Lily. For any social media users in the audience, the hashtag for today's event is LSE Events. All one word. Sorry. This event is being recorded and will hopefully be made available as a podcast subject to no technical difficulties. As usual, there will be the chance for you to put your questions to the panel. And just fair warning, I'm going to be very strict. Keep short questions and comments so lots of people can ask questions. And I'll take questions from both the audience and our online audience. And for the online audience, you can submit your questions via the Q&A feature at the top left of your screen. And please include your name and affiliation. And for those attending in person, I will let you know when we will open the floor for questions. Kindly raise your hand and wait for the stewards who have a roving microphone. I will try to ensure a range of questions from both online and in-person audiences. And now I'm delighted to hand over to Elif.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Hi. I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Thank you so much for the very warm and kind introduction. I also want to thank you for being here. I'm going to try to keep my talk short because I'm really looking forward to turning this into a dialogue together. But I also want to begin, with a question that has been on my mind often lately, a question that, for me at least, carries a growing sense of urgency and importance. And that question is about creativity in the midst of chaos. It's about literature in an age of crisis. I just cannot stop asking myself, what can fiction mean, or even hope to mean, when it feels like the world is falling apart and when it's unraveling fast? Can poetry exert any meaningful impact when there's so much suffering, injustice, and entrenched inequality? What is the role of art in the face of amnesia, disorder, destruction, division, but also narcissism? And when I say narcissism, I mean both individual, but also sometimes collective narcissism. What can the literary imagination offer humanity when the center no longer holds and all that is solid melts into air? In the words of the late American philosopher Marshall Berman, what can fiction give us when so many changes are happening simultaneously and with such bewildering speed that it allows no time, no space for reflection, introspection, or meditation? It feels as though we have been catapulted into a new era whose parameters we are yet to even begin to understand. But it wasn't always like this. If I may take you back in time a little bit, you know, even a few years back, in 2024, for instance, most of the problems that we're facing right now were still happening back then. But at the same time, in 2024, there was an air or a time of expectation, you know, promise, maybe even hope in the air. Why? Because 1.6 billion people globally went to the polls in 2024, right? That year was a time of unprecedented, concentrated democratic activity. And therefore, it was full of promises, lots of empty promises too. But, you know, there was some hope in the air and a lot of incautious confidence, passionate speeches, fiery rhetoric. Many voters back then were keen to express their discontent, and express it they did. This was a mammoth year of elections around the world in which fundamental issues from climate breakdown to inequalities, social and political inequalities, were brought to the forefront. But since then, I think what we have seen in these past months is mostly an intellectual and an emotional fatigue, and maybe a growing despair that things are not getting any better. If anything, they're getting much, much worse. What we are used to calling the liberal international order no longer carries weight. Deeply fractured, unable to hide its cracks, it is coming apart. Simply put, uncertainty is everywhere. Now, excuse me, those of us who are old enough to remember, if I may take you further back in time, the late 1990s, early noughties, it was a time of extreme optimism back then. And I think the biggest optimists at the time were coming from the world of tech industries. They would tell us that if, you know, you could spread technologies thanks to the proliferation of digital platforms, democracy was going to come into every cranny, into every corner of the universe. Now that the Berlin Wall was no more, now that the Soviet Union had dissolved, it was the triumph of liberal democracy. It was even said to be the end of history. And from that moment onwards, the expectation was that it would be just a linear, steady, progressive march onwards. Because how could it be any other way since we had entered the age of information? as information spread, the expectation was that human beings, individuals, would become informed citizens. Informed citizens would make informed choices, and therefore democracy would not only survive, but thrive in every corner forever. In fact, there was so much trust, there was so much sincere faith, actually, in the digital platforms back then, that I remember this very vividly. A young Egyptian couple at the beginning of the Arab Spring, they named their newborn baby daughter Facebook. I do think about Facebook a lot. Because she's a teenager now, and imagine what kind of a world have we given her and how sharply and sadly different it is compared to the world that was expected back then. So what has happened is that the pendulum has swung from that extreme optimism to a moment of extreme pessimism, and that's where we are right now. Even a new word has been coined to describe the zeitgeist, and that word is polycrisis. Lots of crises are happening at the same time. So in this talk, if you can indulge me, if you can allow me, I want to get help from poets and novelists to approach this polycrisis, because I think they have a lot to teach us. And if I may start with T.S. Eliot, he makes a very, very helpful distinction between three concepts, between information, knowledge, and wisdom. And he reminds us that these are completely separate things. So what we have right now is way too much information, a flood, a deluge of information. And the truth is, our brains are not wired in this way. We cannot process this much information. What we end up doing is just we scroll up and down, we get snippets of information, morsels of information, and then we move on to the next bit of information. But I am going to argue in this talk that actually all these morsels of information are an obstacle in front of true knowledge. What is happening right now is that too much information gives us the illusion that we know something about pretty much everything. You can ask me anything you want. If I don't know the answer, and probably I won't know the answer, but I can Google it, and in the next 5 minutes, I'll be able to say a few words about that subject, making me assume that I got this, you know? I know something about this subject. So what is going on right now is we forgot to say, I don't know. When was the last time we ever said, I don't know, to any question? When was the last time we said, you know, I haven't made up my mind yet about that issue. I'm still thinking. I'm still on a journey. I'm still learning. We don't say these things anymore. Only and only when we're talking with children, because children are so courageous, they're so sincere, and they ask the biggest philosophical questions about mortality, about God, about existence. They ask these big questions, and then we say, oh, I don't know, to them. But not to anyone our age. We don't use these words anymore. And that is a pity, because I don't know was the beginning of philosophy. It was extremely important for ancient philosophers, pre-Socratic philosophers. It was important for Socrates himself. So I think what is happening right now is we have way too much information, but little knowledge and even less wisdom. And maybe the question we need to ask ourselves is, how can we change this ratio? How can we turn it the other way, you know? So let us spend less time with information, but much more time with knowledge. And that means we need to slow down, because knowledge cannot be rushed. And I think we all need to slow down, actually. For knowledge, we need books. We need focused podcasts, we need slow journalism, we need literary festivals, we need cultural spaces such as this one. And we don't have to agree on everything, but we have time for each other and we listen to each other. And then there is wisdom, which I think is something else altogether. For wisdom, we need emotional intelligence. We need to bring the heart and emotions into the conversation. The great philosopher Spinoza, he has this very interesting passage in which he talks about, if you want to tackle or if you want to deal with an emotion, a strong emotion, you cannot do that via using reason alone. you have to come up with another emotion, equally strong, possibly even stronger. The only emotion that I know which is stronger than hatred, which is stronger than fear, is love. So we have to go back to emotions. But let us stay with T.S. Eliot a little bit longer, if you'll allow me. There is a poem, or there are these verses in Burnt Norton, where he says, words strain, crack, and sometimes break, under the burden, under the tension, slip, slide, perish, decay with imprecision, will not stay in place. Words will not stay still. I think the kind of world that the poet is talking about in these words, in these verses, is a world in which language itself is falling apart under so much pressure. And that is a dangerous thing, because then language can be used to othernize, to dehumanize, to divide and distance people from each other. But I also want to focus on the last line that I read. Words will not stay still. I think there's also a lot of hope there. You know, there's both. Maybe the sorrow of what is happening to language under all this pressure, but there's hope as well, because you cannot control words. Despite these walls, despite these barriers, frontiers, words will continue to migrate, journey. They will continue to connect us beyond borders and beyond boxes. And I want to hold on to that thought, because throughout this talk, because I think there's something very positive there as well. Now, one other thing I want to very quickly mention about that time of immense optimism is that back then many people interpreted the world in a very dualistic way. We have been told that if you lived in the Western world, if you were a citizen of the Western world, then you didn't have to worry that much about the future of human rights, women's rights, LGBTQ plus rights, or democracy in general, or rule of law, because all of these things had been achieved in the West, done and dusted. It was in those other lands over there, the liquid lands, where you had to worry about these things. So there was the safe lands or solid lands and the liquid ones. That was a very dualistic interpretation of the world, and that went on for a very, very long time. But fast forward, I think right now we know better. We know that there's no such thing as solid lands versus liquid lands. And the truth is, we're all going through liquid times. Yeah? As the Polish-British sociologist and philosopher Zygmunt Bauman told us very early on, actually. What does that mean, liquid times? It means that what is happening over there can happen elsewhere. It can even happen here. It also means that there's no guarantee that time will always move in a steady march of progress, that actually sometimes countries can go backwards. Even generations can make the same mistakes or similar mistakes to those that their great-grandparents had made. So there is no such guarantee that the arc of history will always bend towards justice. We want to believe in that, and that's inspiring. But as I said, there's no guarantee. So where we are right now, I think we are in the age of angst. I believe everyone is right now so anxious. There's an existential anxiety that cuts so deep, young and old, east and west. So many people are affected by this. Maybe the only difference is some people hide their emotions or repress their feelings more than others. But that is the only difference. When you scratch the surface underneath those very polished social media facades, I think many people are struggling a lot. Not only anxiety, I believe this is the age of three A's: angst, anger, and AI. And that is a very explosive combination. But I think instead of acting as if we're not struggling with these difficult or intense emotions, it is better and healthier to openly talk about them, and also to openly talk about our mental health struggles as well. Emotions are not a sign of weakness. And I think definitely they're nothing to be ashamed of. They are all sources of raw energy. So the question is not whether we are feeling anxious or angry or frustrated or depressed. Of course we're feeling all of these things if we are following what's happening around the world. But then the question is, what do we do with these sources of raw energy? There's a very powerful quote by Toni Morrison, which is very dear to me. And it's simple, but I find it very inspiring. She says, sometimes I feel so angry. There's so much happening, right? Not only the injustices that we see outside, but the repetitiveness of it. All these, as if we have learned nothing from history. So she feels angry. But then the next line in the quote says, then I sit down at my desk and I write. So the question for me is, can we take our anxiety and turn it into music? Can we take our anger and turn it into activism? Can we take our depression and turn it into community work? How can we transform all these troubling and intense emotions into something much more positive and constructive, not only for ourselves as individuals, but also for our communities, for our societies, and for humanity? And I want to mention a few names, a few poets or writers who have managed to do exactly that. One of the examples I want to focus on in this talk is a Ukrainian-Russian poet called Anna Akhmatova. She lived through incredibly turbulent, disturbing times. She experienced the terror of Stalinist regime, authoritarianism, censorship. She saw how her own husband was executed, her own son was imprisoned. Her poems were censored, and the only way many of her poems have survived is when people memorized them and then they smuggled them out of the country. There's a story about Anna Akhmatova from the 1930s in which she stands in front of a prison. It's a very cold and bleak day. All these people are waiting outside. Inside the prison, there are political prisoners, right, imprisoned for just expressing dissent. And the families are waiting outside without knowing if they'll be able to see their loved ones. There's so much hunger, cold, and despair. And she sees this woman shivering in the cold. Her lips have turned blue from the chill. It's the same woman that comes to Anna Akhmatova and says, just one line, she says, can you describe this? Because she knows she's a poet. And Anna Akhmatova says, I can. I do not interpret her answer as a sign of arrogance. I don't think she's trying to say, yes, I'm a great poet, I can describe anything. I think what she is trying to say is, there is room, there's space inside literature to describe this sorrow, the unspeakable, even though that space does not exist, you know, there's no public space for that, there is literary space. She says, when I said that in her anecdotes, something like a smile flashed fleetingly over what had once been the woman's face. That smile flashed and disappeared, just a little hope. The second example that I want to give you is from a very different period, the 13th century, from the part of the world where I come from, and that is the poet Rumi, Jalaluddin Rumi, whose family came from Balkh, Afghanistan. Rumi's family were actually refugees from Afghanistan. They came to Anatolia, they settled down there. He wrote most of his poetry in Persian, occasionally in Arabic. Sometimes he used vocabulary from Greek and Turkish languages. So very cosmopolitan in his upbringing. And I sometimes jokingly think in the region we have these Rumi wars because we Turks like to believe that he's our Rumi, you know? And the Afghans say, no way, he's our Rumi. He originally came from Afghanistan. And the Persians say, you know, just get out of the way, he's our Rumi because he wrote in Persian and so on. But of course, the power of Rumi is that he's nobody's Rumi. He doesn't belong to any ethnicity, any class, any region. He belongs, in my opinion, to humanity. And that is why his voice surpasses geographical and time limits. I'm going to read a very small quote from one of his writings. He says, raise your words, not your voice. It is rain that grows flowers, not thunder. And when you read his poetry, the gentleness, the humanity, the concept of oneness in his poetry, you might think that he must have lived in very peaceful and silken smooth times. But the interesting thing is, Rumi lived in one of the most turbulent and violent times in human history. It was shaped by massacres, by invasions, by plagues, by a lot of suffering. And in the midst of this, the fact that he still kept writing about a more transcendental philosophy, to me, is very interesting. I'm going to speed up a little bit. Today, once again, we are in the middle of wars and we're in the middle of so much destruction. What can fiction offer in the face of all this sorrow and armed conflict? I think about the British poet Wilfred Owen, who was a soldier, of course, during the First World War. And we need to bear in mind that at the time, not many people knew the reality of the First World War because the war was happening elsewhere. And not having the same technologies of communication, they heard about the reality of the war, often belatedly. There was a lot of jingoism, there was a lot of romanticization of warfare. And it was a poet who punctured that myth, and he wrote about the suffering in the trenches. He wrote about the gas attacks, he wrote about trauma that the soldiers experienced and were bound to experience perhaps for many generations. So it was a poet that opened people's eyes. Another example I want to give is the Palestinian poet Mahmoud Darwish, whose work has been profoundly influential, again, for many generations and for me personally. I want to mention his work because for him, literature was a sense of home. Especially a sense of homeland. When home is taken away, when homeland is taken away, it gave him that sense of connection, belonging, continuity. It was also an archive where you could keep the memories that were being systematically erased. So all these different poets, for Anna Akhmatova, I think literature was a way of survival. She breathed like that. For Wilfred Owen, it was a way of witnessing the atrocities and making sure that they were not forgotten. For Rumi, I think it was healing, trying to heal, both for individuals and humanity. And for Mahmoud Darwish, it was a sense of belonging, home and homeland. Very briefly, I want to talk about why memory is very important in my opinion. I think I observe a lot families that have experienced difficulties, challenges, displacement and trauma, not only immigrant families, but any family that has experienced such hardships. And I'm always interested in this tension or dialectical relationship between forgetting, amnesia, and remembering. Now, when you look at these families, usually the elderly are the ones who have experienced the biggest challenges, but they do not like to talk about the past. Not because they have forgotten the past, but they don't even have a language. They don't even know how to talk about these things. So it sits inside their chests, all these unspoken words. The second generation, usually they're not that interested in the past, understandably, because they need to be forward-looking, future-oriented, tabula rasa. They need to find their feet. But that leaves the third or the fourth generations in these families. Interestingly, the youngest in these families today are the ones who are doing the memory keeping. Sometimes you meet like four siblings, only one of them is doing the memory keeping. And why is it like that? I've always wondered. But I would like to hope that writers and poets are the memory keepers of their societies, of their eras. Why is memory keeping important? Not because we want to be stuck in the past, but I believe if we do not study the past, we cannot repair what has been broken. And what we do not repair keeps coming back again and again. Because as mentioned earlier, there is no guarantee that time is a linear, steady march. I believe like buried rivers, inherited traumas flow unseen beneath the structures we have carefully built, threatening to overflow their banks. So memory is important also for healing, for the possibility of healing. But for all of that to happen, and we are in such an important university campus right now, I think we need to encourage intercultural and interdisciplinary conversations. We do not see enough of this happening. There are very important studies being carried out in multiple disciplines, but there isn't enough conversation, enough collaboration among different disciplines. And that's something that I always long for. Coming back to the importance of stories, I think we are, all of us, storytelling creatures. Not only that, we are story-remembering creatures. There are very interesting studies that show if we go to a talk and the talk is conveyed solely with PowerPoint, amazing data, amazing numbers, we love it, we listen, but the next day we've forgotten more than 50%. 3 days later we've forgotten more than 70%. It has evaporated. But if the same talk is conveyed via emotions, stories, then we do remember. It's always those emotions that stay with us. So I believe we have to share not only the family stories that I talked about earlier or the family silences, but also the stories that have been pushed to the periphery in our societies, in our time. One way of doing that, very briefly, in my opinion, is by joining the dots. We cannot be single-issue people. If I may give you an example, in my latest novel, There Are Rivers in the Sky, I wanted to focus on the journey of a single drop of water. The reason why I'm mentioning this is because it made me more aware of the importance of rivers and how our rivers are dying. Now, in many traditional societies, women are water carriers. When there is no water, drinkable water nearby, the distance that a young woman has to walk increases, unfortunately increasing the possibility for sexual violence. To me, this is an important example because we tend to put these issues in separate categories in our minds. We say, here's a drawer for climate crisis, here's a drawer for women's rights, another drawer we open for racial inequality, and so on. But in life, there are no drawers, there are no boxes. Everything and everyone is interconnected. While writing this book, it moved me immensely to study one of the oldest minorities in the region, which are the Yazidis. Now, if you talk to Yazidi grandmothers, you will hear them say to their grandchildren in the month of April, if the children are running around, they say, you know, please walk gently. You know, don't be harsh. Why? Because in the month of April, the earth is pregnant. So you have to treat it with respect. You have to treat it with care. To our rational modern minds, this is just such an irrational thing. But only a culture that has not disconnected itself from nature, only a culture that does not arrogantly assume that it is above nature, will come up with such an approach. Similarly, the Cueros in Peru, in the mountains of Peru, the last Inca community remaining, they believe that everything in nature nurses an element of divinity, a form of consciousness. Not only humans and animals, but also mountains, lakes, stones, pebbles, and definitely trees. From the Yoruba people in Nigeria to the nomadic Sami people across Norway, Sweden, and Finland, I think we have a lot to learn from these time-honored ancient philosophies. And in my opinion, there are three urgent connections that we need to rebuild. One of them is with each other, with our fellow human beings across all borders. The second connection is with nature. Sometimes when we sit under a tree, walk by a river, it really changes our perspective and it teaches us humility. Because we understand, you know, how small we are when compared to their lives. And the third connection that I find very important is the inner one. I do not have a word for that. Some people call it spirituality. Voltaire used to call it the inner garden. So I want to follow Voltaire. But I think we all are responsible for our inner gardens and we need to take very good care of it. So I wanted to... I started with stories. I want to finish with stories. If I may leave you with this thought. While I was writing this book, one of the poems that I studied was the Epic of Gilgamesh. As you know, the Epic of Gilgamesh is over 4,000 years old. And we need to bear in mind that before it was written down by scribes on cuneiform tablets, it was transferred via oral culture. So grandfathers or grandmothers telling it to their grandchildren, which means that it is actually much, much older than we know. Now imagine, since the Epic of Gilgamesh was told and then written down, how many empires have come and gone, how many mighty kings have perished, how many architectural, amazing, you know, magnificent buildings have crumbled to dust. But the very fact that a poem made of breath, and a poem made of the written words, the very fact that it has survived, and here we are 4,000 years later, still talking about it, still learning from it, to me it shows that literature has a very gentle but profound power and resilience that goes beyond the borders of geography and time. And in times of crisis, I think we need literature, we need the art of storytelling, not less, but even more. Thank you so much for listening.
Thank you so much, Elif. I think that was very inspiring, and many, many things to pick up on there. But I would like to invite Lily, our discussant, to share her remarks. And then,
thank you. Thank you so much, Elif. I think it's a great privilege for all of us here to have you in this room with us. My first question for you, I was reflecting on your latest novel, There Are Rivers in the Sky, and I think one of the biggest things I took from it is about how to retain our humanity in the face of so many inhumane processes. And I wanted to think a little bit about your story, and I was curious if you could tell us a little bit about your childhood and what is it that brought you or drew you towards themes of social inequality, otherness?
Thank you so much. I mean, maybe very briefly I can mention that I was born in France, in Strasbourg, but I did not live in Strasbourg for a long time because my parents got separated. My father stayed in France, he got married again, and my mother brought me to Turkey, to Ankara. And so from this very cosmopolitan environment in Strasbourg, you know, lots of students, university students, smoking gloas, talking about revolution, reading Althusser, Jean-Paul Sartre, not so much Simone de Beauvoir. I came to Ankara, to a very, very conservative, very inward-looking, very patriarchal neighborhood, and this was my grandmother's, my maternal grandmother's home. I think I felt like we were a little bit like the odd ones out, you know, I couldn't quite fit in. But what stayed very vividly with me, and this is something I genuinely want to support as best as I can, is this notion of solidarity, this notion of sisterhood. Why do I say this? Because when my mother came back from France, because she had made a mistake, and she had a mistake in the sense that she had dropped out of university when she got married, by the time she came back as a young divorcee, she had no diploma, no career, no money, nothing to fall back on. And usually women in such situations would be immediately married off at the time to someone older, which is exactly what the neighbors were trying to, you know, arrange as a marriage. And it was my grandmother, who herself had been pulled out of school for being a girl in Turkey and who wholeheartedly believed in women's education. It was my maternal grandmother who interfered, and she said, no, my daughter should go back to university. You know, she should have choices in life, and until the day her mother is ready, I will raise my granddaughter. So it was very unusual. I stayed with grandma for many years, but the very fact that these two women supported each other is something I have never forgotten. And the second thing, if I may quickly share, that I have never forgotten is when I think about grandma, she was a very compassionate woman, and she was very wise. As I said, she had not graduated from a, you know, high school. She had never received proper education, and yet she was so wise. So she showed me that one might graduate from a very posh school but can still be ignorant, or one might not have the same chances in life, but one can still be wise. You know, there are different paths to knowledge, and it's up to us as human beings to expand our knowledge, to expand our hearts. I think she was the one who taught me. From one of them, from Grandma, I think I got my love for oral storytelling, oral culture, and from my mother, my love for written culture and the canon of the literary fiction.
That's so beautiful. I mean, I'm thinking about your framework of information and knowledge and wisdom. And I know a lot of people in this room are writers, maybe social scientists, researchers. And I'm curious to think about you as a novelist. How do you approach the language of social justice differently from, for example, a researcher or perhaps a politician? I'm just curious what you think are the gaps in social science, academia, for example, and activism, and what is it that fiction and novelists can bring to that conversation?
Yeah, I so appreciate this question. Unfortunately, it's difficult to talk about emotions, is it not? I mean, often I think there's a lot of pressure, particularly on young people, but also on women, that in order to be perceived as strong, we have to constantly put our emotions in the back burner. But as I try to mention, I see emotions as a source of raw energy. It pains me that often, you know, I studied political science, and it's not empirical data. It's not measurable data. Emotions and feelings are often underestimated, which I think is a pity, and it's also quite misleading because we live in an age in which emotions guide and misguide politics. And vice versa, we have to talk about emotions. And it also breaks my heart that often populist demagogues are far better than their, you know, democratic counterparts in terms of connecting with people's emotions, in terms of connecting with the heart. They speak straight to the heart, not only to reason. So we have to understand the power of emotions. We have to also honor if people have anxiety, if people have worries. We need to understand the root causes of these things, not look down upon people. So I really find emotional intelligence and emotions in general a very neglected subject across academia and media.
And you mentioned about the poly crisis.
Yeah.
And, you know, in this age where we're facing climate change, the rise of fascism, the decline of democracy, it's so many big things that we're up against. But at the same time, I noticed here in the UK, for example, there's been a decline in arts funding. I think arts teaching in secondary schools has gone down by 25%, and arts funding has gone down by 18% since 2010. And so what would you say, for example, to the government about what is the value of funding stories and culture in this moment?
Yeah, I'm very grateful that we're talking about this, because I think in times of crisis, it's a huge mistake to think that arts and humanities are a luxury, you know, that can be discarded. Just the opposite. We need the arts, we need the humanities all the more in times of crisis. Sometimes when you shut down a library, when you shut down a cultural center or youth center, it's not only that specific, you know, building that you're closing, the opportunity that many children, many young people from often disadvantaged backgrounds, this is the only chance they have to go beyond the boxes that we have unfairly pushed them into. It is via music, it's via dance, it's via sports, it's via knowledge. So shutting down the arts, I think, has massive political consequences as well as humanitarian ones. I just find it completely unacceptable that we approach academia as if there was a hierarchy, you know, some disciplines at the top and the arts at the bottom. We have had even politicians in this country telling us that the maths, you know, mathematics, the, you know, engineering and science, etc., were much more important. All due respect for these fields. And if a young person, if a child has the ability and the interest to go towards these fields, it's our duty to support them. But equally, if a child is interested in the arts, if a child wants to be a poet, you know, a dancer, who are we to cut it off and tell him or her not to do that? So the hierarchy is something that really, really troubles me.
And I wanted to also ask about the sort of repercussions you've faced as a novelist. Mm-hmm. You've faced years-long battles, doxing, political persecution, and I'm wondering, for writers in the room, how are you able to cultivate that courage and resilience against this persecution? You've mentioned solidarity, for example, institutional support. Would just love to hear your reflections on that.
I really, really appreciate your question. I think, you know, maybe the word courage is really something I would not use for myself. I would use curiosity. I want to be a curious mind. I want to be a learner. I want to learn from multiple disciplines. It breaks my heart that particularly as women, especially as women writers from the non-Western parts of the world, or writers from minority backgrounds, we're not encouraged to write, you know, novels that are not immediately associated with our identity. For instance, if you're an Afghan woman writer, almost no one expects you or encourages you to write sci-fi or avant-garde fiction. Why not? You know? But you're expected to write about the problems of women in Afghanistan. And please don't get me wrong, the voices of women in Afghanistan, the stories of women in Afghanistan, so crucial and important, we need to amplify. But what I am opposing is just cornering a writer and a label and putting a label on her or him and saying these are the types of stories that you can write and nothing more than that. That is what I want to challenge. So all these glass walls. I think these are very, very challenging times for all of us. I mean, who would have thought that one of the most unsettling, I don't want to say dangerous, but unsettling jobs in America today would be the job of a librarian? I mean, librarians, such gentle, amazing souls, genuinely dedicated to books, are now at the forefront of this madness. Why? Because the number of book removals and book bans. They have to defend the books on the shelves of their schools, of their libraries. So I think it's a challenging time for all of us. But once again, we need to be in this together. Our stories, our destinies are interconnected. Nobody is isolated. The worst thing we can do, if I may quickly add this, you know, earlier I mentioned this is the age of three A's, anger, anxiety, and AI. But if it were to become the age of four A's, I think then it would be a much more dangerous world. What I mean by that is when we add apathy to the equation. So the moment we become numb, the moment we become desensitized, disconnected, the moment we stop caring about what's happening in Gaza, what happened to those girls in Iran, 175 girls, you know, what happened in Sudan, what's happening in Ukraine, but also what's happening to my next door neighbor. Maybe my next door neighbor also needs help. So local and global, we can think together. But my point is, let us not become desensitized. I think apathy is a very dangerous threshold.
And I think that ties in a lot with the power of literature as an antidote, I think, as you're mentioning, to be able to move us. And my last question is, I know you've said before that you don't like literature that preaches, you prefer literature that asks questions. Don't know if you're allowed to say, but I know that you're working on a new novel, and I was wondering what sort of questions you are writing towards.
That's so kind. Actually, it's a little bit connected to some of the questions I raised today, because for the new novel, this question that was the starting point was creativity in a time of chaos. I felt very down myself, you know, what is the point of fiction when so much is happening? And I wanted to seek guidance from authors who have gone through very turbulent times themselves. So I am writing about a very well-known author who lived in a very, very violent and turbulent time and who is known as the connoisseur of women's minds, but I want to turn it upside down and I want women to tell his story.
Looking forward to that. Thank you, Lily.
Thank you.
been fascinating so far. And now I'd like to open it up for the audience, you know, following this very insightful discussion. So I'm going to take questions from the audience here. Okay, we'll start with you. Right there, yeah. And two more. Okay, one and two.
Hi, Eli. Thank you so much. My name is Zoe. I'm in the Department of Geography and Environment as a PhD student. I was quite curious about the role of the body in terms of functioning as a mode of storytelling. Because you spoke a lot about, you know, the power of words, you know, as a site for memory keeping. But how does the body then function as that function, especially given how ephemeral it actually is?
Thank you. That's a good question.
Thank you.
Yes. Hi, thank you so much for this talk and for you and for your beautiful books. I'm always very impressed by kind of the storytelling and the amount of research that goes into your books. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the process of researching and writing.
Research.
Up front, please. Thank you.
Thank you so much for the wonderful talk and also for the great questions. It was very nice to be reminded of a time of optimism in the late 1990s and early 2000s, especially around the theme of social media and technology. And it's probably now that we're particularly negative about the impact of AI because we've experienced how that has turned around and the negative impact that has had in recent decades. So as an artist, you probably have thought quite a lot about the role of AI and how that impacts your work. Is there anything that you can take from your thoughts that would constitute a positive?
Okay, those are three very
In the context
questions.
Of art.
So we had a question about the body as a tool of storytelling, the process of researching your writing, and the role of AI. Is there anything, how it impacts your writing, and is there anything positive?
Yes, beautiful, beautiful questions. I'm very grateful. You know, with regards to the role of the body, I'm always amazed by artists who use their bodies to tell stories. And of course, in the visual arts, in dance, in choreography, in music, in cinema, this is so strong and so profound. And you know, I'm always inspired by that, and I long for more conversations among different disciplines of art. The only thing is, as a novelist, our job is very solitary. While we're writing, we're very much on our own. One thing you realize as you get older, writing does not get any easier. Sometimes people with good intentions, they think, oh, you know, if you've written an X amount of books, then as if you've cracked the code, you know this. There is no such thing. Whether it's your first book, fifth book, really doesn't matter. You go through these valleys of anxiety, mountains of depression. One week you feel like, I got this, so I'm writing an amazing novel. And really the next week you're crawling on the floor because everything you've written previously is so bad. And you just have to chuck it out. So, and I observe these things. And I think we don't talk about these things enough, how age affects us, how it becomes more difficult to just sit down for long hours. But these are honest conversations that I find important. But overall, with regards to the body, all I can say is a more holistic approach is something that I'm interested in, one that doesn't necessarily only put the mind, the rational mind, at the top, right, but tries to connect it. And there are new approaches that also talk about our guts as our second brain, right, bringing the entire body together in a holistic approach. So that's something that I'm very much interested in and I want to learn more about the process of research. All I can say is I love learning, and I think as writers we need to be two things all our lives. We need to be good readers, curious readers. Let us not read the same type of books over and over, because that's another cocoon, but let's read across the board. And the second thing we need to be is listeners. I think we need to be learners, and sometimes we need to unlearn. So research is a big, big part of what I do. I love giving it my best. Whatever I write about, for The Island of Missing Trees, I had to study the lives of mosquitoes because it felt so crucial to understand this fig tree or the lives of wasps and bees. Nothing is small, nothing is insignificant. We just keep learning. For There Are Rivers in the Sky, all I can say is the research process was really intense, interdisciplinary, a bit insane, but I loved it. About the AI, I'm with you. I mean, but we have to find those pockets of optimism as well about AI. All I can say is, because we have seen AI in a very positive light for so long, I think we urgently need to be aware of its dangers. It's a bit like the moon, isn't it? It does have a bright side. How can I underestimate the power of AI in terms of connecting people, especially when you come from a land where we have seen media freedoms shrink? I do find these platforms still important. What AI promises, particularly in medicine, we haven't even we haven't started to understand it yet. Immense progress it is promising. So all of that I respect. However, the dark side of AI is something that we need to be not aware of only, but we need to be involved in this conversation, because many of us, with good intentions, we think that technology is too complicated. So we don't talk about this enough. But I think technology is way too important to leave it just to tech companies. Personally, I wouldn't want any person, any political party, any company to have absolute power. The monopoly of power is a very dangerous thing. So as we build on the positive sides of AI, we need to be also very aware and alert about the dangers that it entails.
Thank you. I'm going to take two questions from the online audience. So this is from Octavia Maria. The question is, how can we nourish the hope in ourselves and in others, especially since there is so much cynicism and disillusionment? Octavia is joining from Romania. And the second question is from Umay, an MSc student and aspiring writer. I was wondering, how have you channeled raw energy into writing? Oh, this is interesting. How have you went from an idea to a whole book and accumulated the knowledge? Where would you advise aspiring writers to start? And finally, from Katie Rubin, thank you for the wonderful talk. Katie is a senior Atlantic fellow, AFSI fellow. I was struck by your comment that we live in an age when emotions guide and misguide politics, and that we shouldn't discard emotions as data. Perhaps a tricky question, but how would you imagine a future politics in which emotions are given real credit as essential data? What might that look like? So how do we nourish hope? Where do you start? I think, Lily, you asked that question earlier. And then how do we channel emotions?
All of them. So incredibly important questions. I mean, you might disagree with me, but I don't like cynicism much, you know? Mm-hmm. It's so easy to be cynical all the time. And I say this as someone who finds optimism difficult. Sometimes I jokingly think, you know, I'm Turkish, I can't be very optimistic. It's really not in my DNA. Like, when you open a map of Europe and you trace the river Danube with your finger, I think as we move eastward, the level of optimism drops and drops and drops. So Romania, Bulgaria, Hungary, the Black Sea, we're not very optimistic people, naturally. And pessimism comes to me more easily. For optimism, I need to put effort into it.
Yeah, I know.
You know what I'm saying.
I know exactly what you mean. I'm even further east than you, so yeah.
We understand each other. But I think it's okay for the mind to be a little bit pessimistic, as long as we can keep the heart hopeful. But we cannot do that alone. Yeah. Only and only when we connect with our fellow human beings. That's why these connections are so important. When I hear your story, that gives me inspiration. And maybe something I say today will give inspiration to someone else. But this is how words travel, as T.S. Eliot said. You know, they don't stay still, and there is hope in that. About the raw energy, I think, you know, when I'm writing, many artists, I believe, feel this way. It's almost like you're using a different part of your brain. As writers, we are not wise, knowledgeable people at all. I think we're a mess. And in our daily life, we are full of like narcissism, anxieties. But what happens is when you sit down at your desk and when you start writing, at least this is how I feel, it's almost like you tap into something that is bigger than you, older than you, and definitely wiser than you. And that to me is the art of storytelling. It is so ancient, it's so universal, and it doesn't belong to anyone, it doesn't belong to any single ethnicity, it really belongs to all of us, one single human race. So I feel like I am, my energy is connected with something much bigger than my small, you know, self, and that helps a lot. About the emotions and what kind of politics would that be?
Yeah.
I think it would be a much more honest politics, wouldn't it? I would love it if politicians could also show, you know, their vulnerability. One thing that helped me a lot is, you know, I'm an introvert. I used to find it very difficult to give talks in public spaces. And I remember I couldn't even move when I had a public talk. But now I give talks very easily. What has changed? I want to share this with you. The only thing that has changed is I realize I don't have to be perfect. You know, I can make mistakes. If I make mistakes, I will apologize. But I don't think people are here to see or hear perfection. It's okay, right? We can share our heart, we can share our vulnerability, we can share our emotion. And those who are listening to me, or when I go to a talk, when I'm listening to someone else, we're all human. Nobody's above, nobody's inferior. We're all in this together. And that helps a lot. That takes the pressure off. And I think it will help politicians as well. So we have to come back to that point of vulnerability and not being afraid of showing our emotions.
Yeah, thank you. I agree. Okay, so we've got one there, and to be equitable, I'm going to go up. Yes, that individual. And that individual. So maybe we'll start with you.
My name is Christina Lam. I'm a foreign correspondent for the Sunday Times. Thank you, Ali, for that beautiful talk and for your generosity of spirit and sharing the things that you've said. You said something which I think about a lot, which is if the three A's become four A's, the danger of a world of apathy. We're living in a time with so many conflicts, more conflicts than any time since the Second World War. How do you keep people caring in a time like this, do you think?
So how do we keep people caring? Yes, please.
Hi, Aviv. I'm Roshni. I'm your dear lecturer. I'm studying public policy here at LSE. Thank you. It's an honor to be here listening to you. I know there are a lot of writers in this room here who read your words and go, oh, I wish I'd written that. Oh, it's so beautiful. Who are the writers that you read and who you go, oh, I wish I'd written that?
That's a good question. Okay. Yes.
Hi. First, I just want to say that I'm right here.
Hi. Hi.
That your voice and your presence has been just an incredible gift. I just wanted to say that, and I think everybody in this room feels that. And I think that that's part of my question in a way it's about the embodiment, but the stories that we tell about ourselves to each other oftentimes reproduce these representations that we have that are performance and are not really true to what we feel inside. And I think the real work then begins there. Mm-hmm. But it's almost that the fifth A would then be awareness, that it takes awareness to begin that work.
Beautiful.
And that we are each other's stories, the stories that we tell about ourselves to each other. Mm-hmm. We are each other's stories. We are each other. Yeah. And so I think this was something that occurred to me while you were speaking and through your voice and through your presence. That is something that then can be transmitted to me. And I just was wondering if you could comment on that. So,
Thank you. That's a very lovely question.
So appreciate each question. I mean, Christina, your work is so important. War correspondents, female war correspondents, at a time like this, I think we should thank you, you know, for showing us the truth, but also coming back to your question, for helping us to care. Because when we don't know, when we don't see, it's all numbers. And we don't feel numbers. really the human brain does not process the difference between 5,000 people dead and 50,000 people dead. Does it register anything, that difference? But if I know the stories of people, the stories of individuals, their names, their dreams, their sorrows, that they had families, that they had aspirations, just like we all have, then it sinks in. So I really find the work of war correspondents incredibly important, and that's also storytelling, isn't it? I think, you know, I wasn't able to maybe add this, but I find it a bit unfortunate that in the English language we use the word fiction as if it were the opposite of facts. Mm. And sometimes people say, I understand, but they say, I want to escape reality, that's why I'm reading novels. I really disagree with that. I think fiction brings us closer to truth, but it does it in its own way. So how do we make people care, you know, or help people care more about people living in other parts of the world or on our street? I really find that local and global connection important by learning their stories, by learning that they're not numbers, but by learning that they're just humans, just like me. About the kind of books that I... You know, I'm jealous about that. I would love, I wish I could have, oh, there's so many. But all I can say is, as I mentioned, I really love eclectic reading lists. And I'm a curious reader. I don't believe in highbrow literature versus lowbrow literature. Who makes those distinctions? Let us read anything and everything that speaks to us in that moment in time. But let us keep the mind open, the heart open. You know, I believe our reading list should not be only Eurocentric. Let's read from all over the world. But I'm equally interested in, you know, political philosophy as in cookbooks. Why not? Cookbooks are amazing to understand the culture, traditions. Food is a language. Food is how we communicate, right? Let's read graphic novels, poetry, but let's also read fiction. I think inside fiction, there is everything that is inside life, and there's also emotional intelligence. So it's the interdisciplinary nature of the reading that is important to me. And if I may very briefly thank you for your very kind comments. Rumi actually has a poem like that. He says, you know, sometimes you hear like a musical instrument, and that melody you transfer to another instrument, another, and it has reached you now. And from you, it will reach another person. But the idea that I get when I read that poem is that we are in this together. And that is so important. It's simple, but so powerful, because we live in an age in which we're constantly pushed into boxes. And we are told that we must remain in those boxes once and for all. Identity, the way it's being taught to us, is solid, monolithic, unchanging. And I think that that is so far from truth. Because our main element is water. We are all so complex, so layered. When I look at myself, of course, being Turkish is a big part of who I am, but I equally feel attached to the Balkans, the Middle East. I feel European, the values that I share. I've become British over the years, despite what politicians have been telling us during the Brexit saga. I want to call myself a citizen of the world. A citizen of humanity, one humanity, you know, one human race. That doesn't mean that you're floating in the air without a care. It means you have multiple attachments. But I believe you might have been, even if you were born and raised in one village, you still have multiple belongings through your ancestral heritage, maybe your sexual identity, maybe many other stories that I am not aware of, but layers upon layers of, you know, of beauty, complexity. So all I can say is we're not allowed to bring out that multiplicity, let alone celebrate it. And I think multiplicity is beautiful. Pluralism is beautiful, both within and outside within our societies.
Thank you. So I'm going to read some of the three of the questions from online. Mehraba Elif, I'm a Turkish LSE alumni and I'm in my 20s, no name. I find myself torn between a yearning for home versus a desire to build a future that fits my desired way of life. At this stage, they seem incompatible. I feel like I have to either sacrifice economic political freedom or constantly feel like I am far away from home. Oh, we're getting really deep here. Second question is from Anthony. LSE external alum. How does political power in the Middle East affect your writing? Listening to Israeli politicians like Naftali Bennett threatening Turkey must be disconcerting. And then a question from Theodora. Thank you for an inspiring talk. How subjective is the memory of oral histories? There are a lot of historians who look down on oral histories precisely because of their subjectivity. Are they correct? Interesting.
Interesting questions. Yeah. I mean, the question about home, of course, it resonates with me
a
lot.
Yeah.
But I also believe maybe it's possible to have more than one home, you know?
Yeah.
Can it be like that? Can we have, as mentioned earlier, can we have multiple belongings? It is a fractured life, the life of an immigrant, as you can hear in my accent, the words I can never pronounce properly. You know, English is not my mother tongue. I'm writing in a language that's not my native language. And it's tricky because as immigrants, there's always a gap between the mind and the tongue. I think the mind always runs faster. We always want to crack better jokes, but we can't quite get it right. We always want to be able to say more, but we're aware of what we fail to say more than what we manage to say. So that gap is always there with us. But if we learn not, if we can manage not to be intimidated by that, I think it can also be inspiring. All I'm trying to say is, despite the challenges of writing in another language, English also gave me an additional sense of freedom, another zone of existence. So the life of an immigrant, the life of an exile, or the life of anyone who is considering this question of where is home, can be a fractured one. Maybe there's a melancholy to it, and that melancholy will always come with us. I think it will always be with us. But also there's such richness, because you learn from all over the world, from people who come from all over the world. I don't take this for granted. You know, the very fact that in London, when children go to school, they have friends from all backgrounds, all religions and no religions. I cherish that, I treasure that. I think in life we don't learn from sameness, we learn from differences. The same when it comes to the Middle East question. I mean, as a writer, I'm not claiming that literature is apolitical. Of course novels are political. Politics is in everything, in every moment of our lives. As a feminist, I know that the personal is also political. But my primary focus is on human beings and human stories. And my primary focus is how can we manage to overcome this language of hatred that keeps creating more of the same again and again. Extreme violence or extremism on one side creates more of the same on another side. And we have to break this cycle. So as we're talking about injustices, inequalities, the suffering of civilians, innocent people, and we must talk about all of that, but we need to also think about creating a new language that unites people, because enough of all this hatred, which is not getting us anywhere. Forgive me, about the oral stories, subjectivity. That's an interesting one. I mean, I think doubt should always be there, you know? We need to doubt our own truths, our own convictions, revise them. But when I'm writing, I try to think about not only stories, also silences. You know, what are the stories that we haven't heard about? The ones that have been pushed to the periphery. Who is not allowed to tell the story? And can we bring those to the center? So I don't think objectivity or subjectivity is my primary criteria. Yes. I understand for an academic, for a historian, that might be the case. Although there are very interesting historians who do micro-history, going all the way to Carlo Ginzburg. They have done amazing research. For instance, studying what the Inquisition meant for a peasant who was put on trial during the time of Inquisition. So you take the micro, and based on oral stories, you rewrite the story of that era. My point is, we need to be able to look at truth from multiple angles, and it's that nomadic, intellectual nomadic approach that interests me.
Okay, I'm going to take some questions. All right, let's see. Okay, gentlemen there. There, and this time I'm going to take one. There. Striped person. Yeah.
Some years ago, when you were still living in Turkey, you nearly ended up in prison, accused of, I quote, insulting Turkishness, and that was because you wrote about the Armenian genocide in your novel, The Bastard of Istanbul. I'm intrigued, how much interaction did you have with Armenians, both in Turkey and abroad, perhaps in America, while you were doing research and preparing to write this book?
Yeah, thank you so much.
Yes. Hi, Elif, I'm over here in the bottom here. Hi there. My name's Varun, and I'm new to your work. I've read some blurbs of your book in recent weeks and thought this would be a really good thing to come to. And I must say, I've been blown away by the speech and by the discussion afterwards. And I'd love to read more of your work. Mm-hmm. Where would you suggest I start? I hope you've got a favourite. What is your...
That's a great question. Thank you.
That's the most difficult question.
Yes, I'm taking the question from up there.
Yes.
Yes.
Hello. My name's Vanessa. I graduated from my Master's in Human Rights from LSE in 2023. Mm-hmm. I also wanted to say I loved your recent book. My mum and I read it from different cities and we discussed it every week. So thank you for that. I was particularly struck, as I'm sure everyone in the room was, about the fourth A of apathy. Yeah. But then marrying that with your earlier concept of information. Mm. Something that I struggle with a lot is the hyper-availability of information everywhere and feeling so overwhelmed by the mass of devastating information to the point where I can feel myself becoming apathetic because it's too much to comprehend from a very privileged position of seeing it through a screen. So how do we, that would be my question, is how do you begin to engage with these stories?
Beautiful.
Yeah.
Thank you, Vanessa.
Yeah. And thank you for the honesty, you know, because I think it's something that everybody is struggling with. Maybe if I may start with your kind question. Very briefly, when I wrote The Bastard of Istanbul, those of you who are familiar with the novel, this is a novel that talks about a Turkish family and an Armenian-American family through the eyes of women, generations of women mostly. To me, it was important to write it in a constructive way, but at the same time honor the past, you know, what we have forgotten, what we have chosen to forget, to be able to talk about both the beauties and the atrocities of the past, and hopefully never ever make the same, you know, mistakes and horrors, repeat them ever again. It's a way of healing and communicating, connecting. To me, it came as a surprise when the book was put on trial. This had never happened before. We have an Article 301 in the Turkish Constitution that is mostly used against journalists and historians, but it was never before used against a fiction writer. And so I found myself in a very surreal situation because the words of fictional characters were used as evidence in the courtroom, as a result of which my Turkish lawyer had to defend my Armenian fictional characters. You know, as he was defending me. And it was also unsettling because there were groups on the streets calling me a traitor, spitting at my pictures, burning my pictures, burning EU flags. So all of that was unnerving. But I don't want to paint a very bleak picture, because at the time also many people were reading the book, particularly from women. There was an immense heartwarming reaction. I have listened to many Armenian, you know, you asked me if I had listened to Armenians both in Turkey and in the diaspora. I try to listen, I try to read a lot, I like to do research. There are also many families in Turkey who have Armenian grandmothers and they don't know about this and they find it out much, much later in life. These are very painful discoveries, but they're important. So to me, I think it was important to keep my mind and my heart open. Earlier, I mentioned one word. As we keep learning, sometimes we have to unlearn. Because all of us, we internalize so many prejudices, biases against each other. I also experienced this when I was writing The Island of Missing Trees. We grow up in one box and we hear lots of things about people in the other box. But when we are connecting via art, culture, literature, there are no boxes, and we are ready to connect, ready to learn, and ready to revise our own convictions. That kind of openness was, to me, very important. You asked me a very difficult question. I really, really cannot choose a single book. It really depends on you, on, you know, which book speaks to you. Perhaps you can start with The Island of Missing Trees or There Are Rivers in the Sky, but I say this only because those are the most recent ones. If you, you know, push me to a corner and say you have to choose one book and tell me which one is your favorite book, I will always choose the one I'm yet to write. And I really thank you for your honesty about the fatigue that you feel, because we're bombarded by this information. And I know many people who don't even want to read the newspapers anymore. It's just, they say it's too much. But we have to find a way to overcome that. And that's why I think we need to put information aside. It really is not helping us. Scrolling up and down Twitter or whatever it has, it is called right now, that is not helping at all. We have to spend more time in places like this. Again, we can disagree. We don't need to agree on every issue, but we listen to each other. We have to spend more time with books. Let's really, really read more books, because books change the way our brain functions. Let's listen to audio, podcasts. Audio is incredibly helpful. But I think it's a matter of channeling our energy and our time from information towards knowledge and hopefully towards wisdom. All I can say is please try to find the things that work for you. If one platform doesn't work, I've started recently writing Substack. I keep it free. I don't put it behind the paywall. And I like it because it's a platform that is not based on manicured, polished images like Instagram mostly is, or it's not thriving upon anger and division and animosity and clickbaits. But there's more room for essays, you know, and so that platform works better for me. Let's try to choose the platforms that work better for us individually.
Absolutely. So we're nearly at end of time. Alice, and I'm going to take one question from here and one question from there, and we'll end. Oh. Okay.
I'm a writer, and my life's work has been stolen by Meta.
Yeah.
It's probably happened to you as well.
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
happened to literally millions of yeah. creatives across yeah. the world.
Yeah.
We are under terrible threat.
Yeah.
Do you acknowledge the importance of copyright?
Absolutely.
And how can we defend the work of writers and honour the human author?
Oh, you're so
excellent question.
You're so right. Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you. And then the last question is from Senem. As a Turkish Cypriot, when I read The Island of Missing Trees, I loved it and felt very triggered because of all I learned about transgenerational trauma. How do you deal with the triggers and trauma as the one writing it?
Beautiful questions. What you said is so important, and that's why this recent... the developments, the government decision, all of that I'm following very closely. And as you said, Meta is training all these large language models using our books without any permission, any copyright. One other thing that is happening is most of the books that are being used to train these models are Western sources. So the stories of many indigenous tribes, many cultures from different parts of the world, they're also being erased in a weird paradoxical way. So that's also happening. There are layers and layers. I think it's very important that as writers, as poets, we support each other, and in unison we voice our demands, and we stand against this. That's why I was mentioning that no corporate, no tech company should have absolute power. This is not okay. Already writers have so many challenges, from freedom of expression to book removals to book bans that they are dealing with. Already it's a difficult profession, but we don't need this. So I'm very much with you, and I think we need to keep fighting to make sure this does not happen. The question about Cyprus and trauma, I can tell you, I've been wanting to write about Cyprus for a very long time, but I didn't know how to approach the subject because, as you know, if you've been there, this is a beautiful island that we are talking about, but north and south, but it's a divided island, and the wounds are not healed yet. And depending on whom you talk to, there are clashing memories. So how do you approach such a delicate and difficult subject without yourself as a novelist falling into the trap of nationalism or tribalism or just looking at it from one side? I really didn't want to do that. So I didn't know how to approach the subject. I've been thinking about it, I've been reading about it, listening to people, but I couldn't dare to write about Cyprus for many years. And it was the fig tree that allowed me, the idea of a tree that somehow allowed me to approach this story from a completely different angle. And I kept hearing the voice of this tree in my mind day and night. But I wish you could see my agent's face when I when I told him that I'm going to write a novel, there's going to be a tree at the center, and I'm going to make this tree talk. And he's always very supportive and kind, but I saw this flash of panic in his eyes. I really get it, because if it doesn't work, the whole novel collapses, right, in a literary fiction. But I believed in this voice. So it was a tree that allowed me to tell the story of this island, beautiful island, with all its pain, accumulated sorrows, from a completely different perspective. And it showed me that when we destroy each other, when there are civil wars, genocides, wars, and so on, when human beings destroy each other in the name of ideology, in the name of nationalism, in the name of religion, we're not only destroying each other and our futures, the futures of many generations to come, but also nature, also an entire ecosystem, a very delicate ecosystem. So it enabled me, helped me to join the dots. So that's why I'm very grateful to the fig tree.
It was brilliant. Thank you so much, Elif. This
thank
has been
so
absolutely
much.
Brilliant.
Subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.